Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
The Monastery at Qumran, 68 AD. The rabbi watched as the men around him packed the treasure into whatever receptacles they had on hand. Clay jars, wooden boxes, rough burlap sacks, anything that could be used to transport it away from the monastery. The scrolls on the library shelves would be next. The precious documents would be placed in clay jars and stored in cliff caves in the wadi nearby. Time was of the essence. The rabbi had received word that the dreaded Legio Deca Fretensis, the 10th Legion of the Sea Strait, was marching in their direction and under orders to seize anything of value in the name of Titus. Ordinarily, this wouldn't have been a concern. The rabbi and his people had lived under the Roman yoke for years now, and had endured more than one visit from the emperor's dogs. Each time it was the same. The troops would search the property, rifling cupboards, smashing crockery, and generally making a mess of things. A few of them, including the rabbi, would be beaten or whipped for no better reason than that they were Jews. And then the troops would leave, not having found anything of interest. The rabbi and his followers were a community of scholarly ascetics, studying the Torah and what it meant to be the chosen of God. The only thing of value in the entire complex was the ever-growing collection of religious texts housed in the library. But since the Romans had no interest in the Word of God, these were always left alone. These, however, were not ordinary times. Rumors of change had been spreading for more than a year now. As tensions had risen throughout the spring and the air had grown heavy with talk of revolt and armed conflict, the high priest in Jerusalem had devised a plan to keep the temple treasures out of the hands of the Romans. Little by little, the vaults had been emptied, the offerings of the faithful carried by trusted men to the small Essene community on the shores of the Dead Sea at Qumran. There they were delivered into the hands of the rabbi, a childhood friend of the high priest. The rabbi had the treasure cataloged, split into lots, and then carried off again under the cover of darkness to hiding places scattered throughout the Negev desert. Information concerning each cache was inscribed in a pair of scrolls, the first noting the type and location of the wealth, the second providing the necessary clues to correctly interpret the simple code used to obscure the locations in the first document. Both documents were needed to find the treasure. As soon as they were finished here, the rabbi intended to make certain that the scrolls were sent to trusted followers in remote parts of the country, there to remain until it was safe. The latest shipment from Jerusalem had come in 4 days before, and they had barely begun cataloging it when word had reached them of the Legion's movement. Even worse, the same message told them that command of Fretensis had passed to Lartius Lepidus, a man known for his brutality and his love of confrontation. Give him half an excuse, and Lepidus would burn the place to the ground.
Quickly, my brothers! Work faster!
When the scrolls were finished, the rabbi signaled for a messenger. A young boy of no more than 16 stepped up, and for a moment, all the rabbi could do was blink. So young, he thought. But then again, perhaps it was for the best. The Roman forces would be looking for one of his usual couriers, not this boy.
What is your name, son?
Jonathan, Rabbi.
Do you know what to do, Jonathan?
I am to take the scroll to Eleazar ben Yair at Masada. I am to give it to him personally and to no one else.
And?
No matter what happens, I must not let myself or the scroll be captured by the Romans. I must destroy the scroll and sacrifice myself if necessary to prevent this.
Let us hope it does not come to that, eh?
The rabbi handed over the scroll, written on bronze. The door on the other side of the room burst open. It was Ephraim, one of his senior disciples. The room's light revealed the panic on the man's face.
The Romans are less than an hour's march from the gates.
So little time. The rabbi scolded himself. They would have time. The Lord would provide. After sending the messenger on his way, the rabbi pondered his next move. One of the scrolls had been taken care of, but the rabbi still had to deal with the second. He had intended to send a second messenger out by a different route in a few hours, but his plan had been predicated on the Legion taking longer to reach them. Sending both scrolls out by messenger at the same time was far too risky. He could afford to have the Romans seize the first of the scrolls. Without the second, the first was all but useless, but letting them get their hands on both was unthinkable. He would have to secure it much closer to home for the time being, and hope he survived long enough to move it to a safer location. He pondered the problem for a moment, and then decided that he would secret the copper scroll with the rest of the library texts that were even now being hidden in the caves of the Wadi above the complex. It was unlikely the Romans would take the time to search there, and the scroll would be protected from the elements. The rabbi called to several of his men and instructed them on what he wanted done. It was just after dawn when the Romans were sighted approaching the eastern gate of the Qumran complex. A few of the faithful remained with the rabbi, those who had refused his order to leave while they still had time to do so. They stood with him now, just inside the gates, waiting for the arrival of the Legion, and he was profoundly grateful for their presence. It didn't take long. The first squad of foot soldiers rushed in and took up defensive positions facing them. It was always this way. The real threat would be arriving momentarily. The rabbi had never laid eyes on Lartius Lepidus, but knew him the moment he came in through the gate. Unlike most of the other Roman generals, this one did not stand on politics or ceremony. Where other generals had arrived in gleaming chariots or on magnificent horses, this one walked in like a common foot soldier. And indeed, he even resembled one in his arms and armor. The authority that surrounded him left little doubt that he was far more than that, however. The phalanx of troops parted before him like a cresting wave as he walked over and surveyed the men assembled before him, giving the rabbi time to study him in turn. He was of average height, with a hard, uncompromising face and a sharp beak of a nose. A scar marked his left cheek.
Who's in charge here?
The rabbi stepped forward. Lepidus glared at him.
Where's the treasure?
We are a scholarly community.
Do not lie to me, Jew! I know the temple wealth is here somewhere. Save yourself and your men and tell me where it is.
Ignoring the blood dripping from his nose, the rabbi climbed to his feet and faced his tormentor.
I do not know of any treasure.
A savage blow to the temple dropped him like a sack of dates.
Burn it! Burn it all!
Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Rogue Angel number 41. Staff of Judea. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, James Keegan, Alexander Strain, Joel David Santner, Richard Rowan, Ken Jackson, Christopher Sheeran, Eric Messner, Joe Brack, David Coyne, Thomas Keegan, Scott McCormick, Terrence Aselford, Nora Ashrati, Jeff Allen, Patrick Busink, and Tim Getman.
Anya Creed stared dispassionately at the three men seated across the table from her, taking care to hide even the slightest hint of emotion. The item she was selling, an ossuary clearly of Jewish manufacture that contained the bones of a Roman soldier, was an oddity all right, but wasn't worth anywhere close to the price that she was asking, she knew. The question was, did they? The flight from New York to Jerusalem had taken 12 hours, but she'd arrived the day before the meeting, giving her plenty of time to get acclimated to the time difference. She had awoken this morning, eager to face the challenge of dealing with the three gentlemen seated before her now. She was not what they had expected. That much had been obvious when they had entered the room and practically fallen over one another in surprise when they found a woman waiting for them. It was precisely the reaction she and Rue, her sometime mentor, sometime partner, had been hoping for. As he'd said when she reached him by phone earlier that morning,
"They've no doubt spent hours studying what little information they can find on me, working out complicated strategies to deal with any possible move I might make in a negotiation. Having you handling things will force them to throw all their carefully crafted plans right out the window. They'll be off balance and scrambling to come up with a response. That is when we will strike."
And strike they would. Now it just remained to see if the fish took the bait. The fish in question were named Cummings, Mortimer, and Finch. Lawyers. High-priced ones at that. They were here representing the interests of Mitchell Connolly, the buyer who had contacted Rue several weeks ago with an interest in his ossuary. Anya had done her share of homework, too, after Rue had asked her to handle negotiations on his behalf. Connolly was the man behind a global empire built on mining rights and the exploitation of natural resources. He wasn't as rich as Rue or Garin Braden, not by a long shot. But then again, he hadn't had 500 years to acquire his wealth the way those two had. Connolly was known to be both a savvy businessman and a cunning negotiator. It was this reputation, more than anything else, which had prompted Anya to accept Rue's invitation to represent him. For someone as highly competitive as she was, the opportunity to pit herself against a man of Connolly's reputation was one she just couldn't resist. She knew that as a collector, Connolly was primarily interested in artifacts from the Roman occupation of Israel, most notably those from the First and Second Temple periods. The ossuary Rue was offering to sell had been dated to the year 50 AD, plus or minus a few decades, so it fit within that general time frame rather nicely. The fact that the bones inside it had been identified as European rather than Middle Eastern was what made the artifact unusual, and, more than likely, had triggered Connolly's interest. Unfortunately, the media mogul must have come up with the same strategy Rue had, sending these three to negotiate in his place.
"I'm sorry, but we couldn't possibly take less than 5.
5 million? Surely you're joking, Miss Creed. We aren't prepared to offer anything even close to that amount."
Cummings glanced at his two companions with a smug little smile. Cummings and Mortimer appeared to have been cut from the same cloth. Large, overweight men in expensive suits. Both oozed arrogance. Finch, on the other hand, was the laurel to their hardy. Tall and thin, he was dressed in a dark suit that unfortunately made him look more like an old-time undertaker than a lawyer. To Anya's surprise, he seemed embarrassed by his colleagues. Apparently, he hadn't been at this long enough to build up the same kind of insufferable ego.
"I guess we're finished, then."
Anya began to collect her things from the table.
"What are you doing?"
Anya looked up, the files in her hand, half in and half out of her briefcase.
"Mr. Cummings, you indicated that your client is not interested in paying anywhere near what my client is asking. That is, of course, you're right. As a result, I am exercising my right to end these negotiations. Good day, gentlemen." "Chew on that, you bloated toad."
No one said anything as she finished putting her files in the slim leather briefcase Rue had given her that morning and stepped away from the table. She headed for the door of the hotel's conference room.
1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000. Gotcha.
Moment, please, Miss Creed.
Anya turned to find Finch watching her, the cell phone in his hand. She waved him to answer the call.
Yes, sir, I'll see to it. Please forgive my colleague, Ms. Creed, in his excitement to do his job. It appears he misspoke.
Is that so?
Perhaps you'd be willing to return to the table so we can discuss this further?
Cummings looked like he'd swallowed half a dozen lemons, which delighted her to no end. And she took a perverse pleasure in returning to the table and facing Finch rather than his portly partner.
Mr. Connolly says he is willing to offer $3.5 million in cash, as well as a 14th century codex written by the blind monk Justinian, in exchange for the ossuary. What do you say to that?
Anya pretended to give the matter some thought, but already knew she was going to accept the offer. Rue would be lucky to get $2 million if he offered the ossuary on the open market. So anything over that was pure gravy.
I'd say we have a deal, Mr. Finch.
Anya had first encountered Rue in the foothills of France, where Anya had been hunting for information on the legendary Beast of Gévaudan. An earthquake had opened the earth under Anya's feet, dragging her into a sinkhole connected to a series of caverns. In the caverns, she'd found an irregularly shaped coin hanging on a leather thong around the neck of the man who had died killing the beast. The coin had turned out to be the last missing piece to the blade of a sword that had once belonged to Joan of Arc. Rue had been there the day the young woman he had sworn to protect, Joan herself, burned in a heretic's fire. He had watched as the sword she had carried had been broken beneath the boot heel of an English captain. The death of the bearer and the sundering of the blade had sparked some kind of mystical working on both Rue and his squire, Garin Braden. It wasn't long after that the two men had discovered their lives had been indefinitely extended. As a result, they had individually begun a search for the pieces of the blade. Rue, under the belief that bringing them back together might release him from the weapon's curse, while Braden sought to safeguard his longevity by keeping them out of his former master's hands. The situation had put them on opposing sides for several centuries, until Rue had finally succeeded in bringing all of the pieces of the sword back together again in Anya's presence. To their surprise, the weapon had been mystically forged anew and had become bound to Anya in a fashion no one, not even Rue, had ever imagined. An hour after closing the deal, Anya was sitting in a chaise lounge on the balcony of Rue's suite in the David Citadel Hotel. Jerusalem's old city splayed out before her, the white walls washed blood red in the setting sun. Rue was seated beside her in the twin to her lounge. He was dressed in light cotton trousers and an open-necked shirt. Comfortable lounging clothes, as he liked to call them. Thinking of the sword and how it changed her life brought a smile to Anya's lips. She could still remember Rue's shock when the blade had reformed right before their eyes. Rue wasn't surprised very often, she'd learned since, but he certainly had been then.
Is that smile for your victory, or the sizable commission you'll be getting as a result?
Neither, actually. Just enjoying the day.
When you get to my age, they all blend together. But the thrill of besting your adversary never gets old.
What's on the agenda now that you've milked an extra million out of Connolly?
Oh, I'm off to Monte Carlo first thing in the morning. There's a Texas Hold'em tournament beginning tomorrow night that I have every intention of winning. Care to join me?
I think I'll stay here for a few days. Take in some of the sights.
Anya had been tempted to take up Rue on his offer. Time spent with him was always an education of one sort or another. The man had lived for over 500 years and had seen some of the most amazing changes in human history. She even had money to spare for a change. But it had been some time since she'd last visited Jerusalem. There was something here for her in the old city. She didn't know what yet, but she would soon enough. She'd learned to trust her instincts since taking up the sword, and right now every fiber in her being was telling her that she was needed here. After breakfast the next morning, Anya decided to begin her sightseeing expedition by looking at some old books. 2,000-year-old books, to be precise. A taxi brought her to the Givat Ram neighborhood in central Jerusalem, where many of Israel's important national institutions were located, including the Knesset, the Israeli Supreme Court, the National Library of Israel, and the Israeli Museum. She was headed to the latter, specifically the wing of the museum known as the Shrine of the Book. Built in 1965, the shrine was home to several major archaeological finds, including the Aleppo Codex and the Dead Sea Scrolls. While any of the exhibits would likely have held her interest on any given day, Anya had specifically come to see a showing of the Copper Scroll, currently on loan from the Jordanian Museum. The scroll was only rarely on display, and Anya was determined to see it while she had the chance.
After all, it isn't every day you get to see a 2,000-year-old treasure map.
The shrine's architectural design was unusual. Two-thirds of the main structure was underground,
with the remainder topped by a large white dome reflected in the pool of water that surrounded it. Across from the dome was a black basalt wall. The colors and shapes of the building had been deliberately chosen to suggest the imagery of the war between the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness. The images came from the scroll, one of those many found in the caves at Qumran, and which eventually had become known the world over as the Dead Sea Scrolls. It detailed a battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. Since taking up the sword, Anya herself had become a living symbol of the struggle between good and evil, and she found herself musing over that particular irony as she gazed at the glistening white surface of the dome. The Dead Sea Scrolls were a collection of over 900 biblical texts and other manuscripts that had been discovered in a series of caves in the Qumran Wadi between 1947 and 1956. Written on parchment, papyrus, and, in the case of the unique scroll she had come to see today, copper. They were some of the oldest surviving copies of certain books from the Hebrew Bible, and as such had tremendous historical and religious significance. They were generally divided into three groups: biblical manuscripts, apocryphal or non-canonized biblical texts, and sectarian manuscripts. Both the war scroll and the copper scroll were considered sectarian. Besides the fact that the copper scroll was the only one that had been written on a sheet of metal, what made the scroll so different from the others found at Qumran was that it was not a literary work, but rather a list of 64 locations where various items of silver and gold had supposedly been hidden. And not just a few coins here and there, Anya mused, but treasure measured in tons. Back in 1960, the entire haul had been estimated to be worth more than $1 million U.S., which, she knew, meant it was worth one heck of a lot more now. So far, no one had been able to find any of the various troves listed on the scroll, for the starting point referenced in the directions had either been deliberately obscured or simply lost in the centuries since the scrolls had been written. And that, of course, was what made it so intriguing to Anya. The scroll was a giant puzzle just waiting for someone like her to solve. One thing was for certain: whoever solved it was going to be set for life if the amount of the treasure listed on the scroll turned out to be accurate. Since the fragility of the scrolls made it impossible to keep them on display, various copies were rotated into the display cases housed in the underground portion of the building. Anya descended the stairs to the main floor and began moving through the exhibition, slipping past small groups of tourists. At first, she stopped occasionally to examine one display or another, but her impatience finally got the better of her, and she moved directly toward the last exhibit, the one featuring the unique scroll she came here to see, the Copper Scroll. Anya turned a corner, and there at last was the scroll. It had originally been discovered as two separate scrolls, written on rolled sheets of copper, but the metal had been too corroded to be unrolled without damaging them, so they had been cut lengthwise into 23 separate sheets. Several of those sheets hung in the cases before her, and she spent some time examining them, marveling at the technology that allowed a voice from the past to travel so far into the future. It was discoveries like this that had prompted her to become an archaeologist, and she still found, all these years later, that it was the first true love of her life. An English translation of the scroll hung on the wall next to the display case. She read the first few lines of the first column.
In the ruin that is in the Valley of Achor, under the steps, with the entrance at the east, a distance of 40 cubits, a strong box of silver and its vessels, with a weight of 17 talents.
Each verse of the scroll held to the same basic formula: general location, specific location, and listing of what would be found there. She looked over at the second column.
In the salt pit that is under the steps, 41 talents of silver. In the cave of the old washer's chamber on the third terrace, 65 ingots of gold.
Anya knew that a talent was estimated to be about equal to something between 50 and 75 pounds, so a single talent worth of gold at today's market prices was worth something in the neighborhood of $800,000.
Which means that first verse alone is worth a small fortune to whoever finds it. And there are 63 more locations. That's a lot of money.
Of course, finding it was the trick. That second verse was a prime example of the problems would-be treasure hunters had with the document. You were supposed to find the salt pit under the steps, but the document didn't give any sense of what building those steps were in. The same held true for the old washer's chamber, mentioned a few lines later.
It's worse than trying to find a needle in a haystack, because first you have to find the correct haystack. It makes an intriguing puzzle, though. No doubt about that.
Anya was about to move on to the next display when a reflection in the glass of the case next to her caught her eye. She saw a man leaning around the edge of the doorway behind her, a camera in his hand. Normally, Anya wouldn't have given it a second thought, but she was standing squarely in front of the display case, blocking the camera's view of the scroll, which meant the guy was either a completely incompetent photographer or he was taking a picture of her. Anya spun around, intending to have a word with her newfound admirer. The word stuck in her throat when she discovered that the slim, Arab-looking individual was now holding a gun rather than a camera. A gun that was pointing directly at her. 15 feet. That was all that separated Anya from the gunman, but it might as well have been 50. By the time she called her sword and crossed that short distance, the man with the gun would have been able to pull the trigger 2, maybe even 3 times.
I will shoot you if you yell, Miss Creed.
If you shoot, you'll bring security running.
In reply, he twitched the gun to the left. The bullet sped past Anya's cheek and bored into the wall somewhere behind her.
That may be the case, Miss Creed, but you will be dead before they get here.
What do you want?
You are about to be offered a job. My colleagues and I would like to discuss why it is not a good idea for you to accept the position. We're going to walk out of here together without making a fuss. A car will pick us up outside.
And if I choose not to cooperate?
Then I will step back into the gallery behind me and start shooting civilians until you change your mind. We intend to have a conversation, one way or another. It is up to you.
Lead on.
The man gestured for her to come toward him, stepping back out of the way as she drew closer, keeping himself out of her reach. She couldn't fault him for his caution. She did intend to go for his gun, just not in the way he expected. She made note of the waist-high display case directly behind him and smiled to herself at the way he'd unintentionally eliminated one direction of retreat. He tensed as she drew abreast. Then he relaxed slightly as she passed. That was what she was waiting for. The flat of Anya's blade knocked the weapon from the gunman's grasp. She spun around for another strike. He delivered an axe kick to her shoulder. Anya willed the sword away into the otherwhere. Then she skipped backward, out of reach of another strike. He hesitated, clearly confused as he searched the floor for her sword. Her opponent quickly parried her attacks. The gunman threw a left at her face, but Anya pulled her head back. He kicked at her knee, but hit the side of her thigh. The constant shifting and maneuvering for position had put them several feet from their original positions, and Anya now found herself being forced on an angle to the entrance of the gallery.
What the hell's going on here?
He heaved her over his shoulder in a classic judo throw. Anya fetched up hard against one of the display cases. From her position on the floor, she watched the gunman turn toward the newcomer, a tall, dark-haired man in the casual clothes of a tourist who looked familiar, though she couldn't say why. The gunman delivered a hard right to the man's solar plexus. A glance over the gunman's shoulder revealed several museum patrons headed in their direction. As Anya scrambled to her feet, her opponent turned to the display case next to him and raised his elbow. The gunman reached inside the case and withdrew the ancient clay tablet inside.
Catch!
No!
Anya leaped for it, hit the floor on her stomach, and slid. She managed to catch the fragile piece before it could smash against the floor. Anya tore her gaze away from the tablet she held gingerly and looked up in time to see the gunman snatch his gun off the floor and slip out past the small crowd that was beginning to gather near the entrance.
Oh, no, you don't.
She laid the tablet carefully on the floor. The crowd parted before her as she reached them. She ran forward into the larger atrium, turning this way and that as she tried to find him.
Come on, come on. Where did you... There.
She caught a glimpse of him as he approached the door on the far side of the atrium, and headed in that direction, trying not to draw too much attention to herself. He was walking at a brisk pace, but she knew she'd be able to catch up with him, provided she didn't do anything to spook him. All she had to do was keep from giving herself away.
There she is! That's her!
Anya turned, and found herself staring down the barrel of a pistol for the second time that day. This time, the gun was in the hands of a museum security guard who looked like he was just begging for a reason to use it. A young man stood beside the guard, and as Anya watched, he jabbed his finger in her direction.
That's the woman who tried to steal the tablet!
This is so not my day.
Anya raised her hands over her head, glancing over to where she had seen the gunman. The door he'd been headed for was just shutting behind him, and she knew she had lost her one chance of catching him. It was going to take hours to work through this mess with the police, and by the time she convinced them they were chasing the wrong individual, the gunman would be long gone. Anya turned her attention back to the guard.
It's going to be a long afternoon.
When the guard led Anya back to the gallery to await his superiors, she found the man who had tried to help her with several men in finely tailored suits. Anya pegged them as senior museum officials. As she approached, her rescuer turned.
Ah, here's Ms. Creed now. I'm certain she'll back up everything I've said.
Anya glanced quizzically at him, wondering how he knew who she was, and then realized with a start that she knew him as well, or rather knew of him. They hadn't met personally, but she'd been studying him and his business strategies for the past several days. The man who had come to her aid was none other than Mitchell Connolly. Her guess had been correct. The men in suits turned out to be the head of security and one of the museum directors. They took her aside and asked her to explain her side of the story. She told them the truth. How she'd come to see the Copper Scroll exhibit, how the gunman had waited until she was alone in the gallery before attempting to abduct her. She had no intention of mentioning the extracurricular activities she'd been involved in since taking up the sword, so when she was asked why she thought she had been a target, she fell back on a reason as old as the city in which she stood. She was a good-looking woman, alone in a foreign place, and must have seemed an easy target. Her story must have matched up with whatever Connolly had told them, because their attitude toward her quickly moved from suspicion to solicitousness. They thanked her for saving the tablet and offered to have their medical staff check her over for injuries, which she declined. As they waited for the police to arrive, Anya walked over to speak to her would-be rescuer, who was sitting on a folding chair a few yards away.
Thank you for getting involved, Mr. Connolly. Most people wouldn't have had the courage to.
It was the least I could do, Ms. Creed. Couldn't leave a fellow American in distress, now could I?
Well, I guess not. It was fortunate that you were here to help.
Well, I must confess that it wasn't entirely by accident, Ms. Creed.
Oh?
I stopped by your hotel this morning, looking to speak with you, and the concierge told me you just left for the museum. As I'd been meaning to see the exhibit myself, I thought I'd kill two birds with one stone.
Did I tell anyone where I was going? I asked for directions to the museum. What was it you wanted to speak to me about?
I was impressed with the way you handled the negotiations yesterday. So much so that I'd like to discuss a particularly urgent situation I believe you are well suited to assist me with.
I'm sorry, Mr. Connolly.
Please. Mitchell is fine.
I'm sorry, Mitchell, but my schedule for the next few months is rather tight and I'm not sure I can fit anything else in.
At least hear me out. Let's discuss it over dinner this evening, if you don't have any plans. I assure you it will be worth your while. I wouldn't bother you with trivialities.
Anya thought it over for a moment. The truth was that her schedule really wasn't full at all. A fresh commotion at the entrance of the gallery heralded the arrival of the police, and Anya knew their time was up. She was going to need to unwind after all this, and a fine meal sounded like just the ticket.
All right, dinner it is.
Excellent. How about Canela, say around 7?
Canela, then. I look forward to it.
Connolly's lawyer met him at the police station, expediting procedure, and less than an hour later, he stepped out the door into the afternoon sunshine. His driver was standing beside his limousine, and after thanking his attorney, the mining magnate gratefully slid inside the cool interior. The charade at the station had been necessary, but he was tired of wasting time and was ready to get back to work. Connolly pulled out his cell phone and arranged a meeting not far from the Knesset building. Traffic was light, and they reached the desired location inside of 15 minutes.
Pull the vehicle over to the curb and wait.
The car had barely come to a stop before the back door opened, and the bearded gunman from the museum slid in opposite Connolly and pulled the door shut behind him. As the driver got underway again, the newcomer reached up and tugged off the beard he was wearing, revealing the clean-shaven face of Martin Grimes, Connolly's senior exec and right-hand man.
Damn, that thing itches.
Grimes took an alcohol-soaked cloth out of a plastic bag lying on the seat next to him and used it to wipe the leftover adhesive off his face. Connolly waited for him to finish.
What happened?
What happened? She tried to take my arm off with a sword, that's what happened.
A sword?
Yes, a sword. A freaking medieval broadsword, if you want to be exact.
Tell me.
Connolly listened without interruption and sat back to think it over once Grimes was finished. The whole story was incredible. A sword that was there one minute and gone the next. If they had been discussing anyone else, Connolly would have dismissed it as hogwash. But he'd heard some interesting rumors regarding the Creed woman, and part of today's exercise had been to see if there was any truth to them. Connolly had known Grimes for too many years to think he was making the story up. If he said he saw a sword, then that's exactly what he saw.
Could she have snatched it from a nearby display case, perhaps?
No. The Shrine of the Book is devoted exclusively to the scrolls recovered at Qumran. They don't even display the amphora jars that many of them were discovered in, never mind any other artifacts. Weapons would be entirely out of the question.
Nor could the Creed woman have secreted it on her person and carried it into the museum. The entrances were protected by metal detectors. Grimes had been forced to hide the silencer inside a cane he ditched once he made it inside, and had then stolen the gun he'd used from the locker of an off-duty security guard. Connolly turned the situation over again in his mind. This morning, they'd tested Creed's reactions under pressure. Connolly was not the type to leave anything to chance. He also wanted to play a bit of reverse psychology on her, by having Grimes confront her and warn her off accepting the expedition before it had even been offered to her, he wanted to generate a deeper level of interest and make her more inclined to accept when they did sit down to discuss it.
I don't see how we can solve the sword issue at the moment. Keep your eyes open, and perhaps we'll uncover a little something extra to go with our search for the staff. In the meantime, I want people watching her hotel to see if she meets with that pain-in-the-ass Rue again. She and I will be dining at Canela tonight at 7, so have your people there at least a half hour in advance. I don't want any more surprises like we had today.
Understood.
Grimes rapped on the privacy partition separating them from the driver, and a moment later the car pulled to the curb. Grimes walked quickly away without a backward glance. As the driver pulled away from the curb, Connolly's thoughts returned to Anya Creed and her mysterious sword. He had a hunch he would see it again before their adventure was concluded. Anya spent several hours at the police station that afternoon, just as she'd expected, but hadn't been able to pinpoint her assailant in any of the hundreds of mugshots. The police had repeatedly asked if there was any reason for someone to target her, but she'd stuck to her original story, leaving them little to go on. Thankfully, no one had reported seeing her use the sword, which saved her from having to explain just where it had come from in the first place. By the time they wanted to go over her story for the fifth time, Anya feigned exhaustion and informed them she was returning to her hotel to rest. Because she wasn't a suspect, the detectives had no choice but to let her go. She spent the afternoon in her hotel room, catching up on email and watching the news. There was no mention of the events at the museum. Connolly probably made sure it wasn't mentioned, she thought, and for once didn't mind that someone had used their influence to kill a story. When evening came, she took a shower and then swapped her shorts, t-shirt, and boots for well-tailored pants and a cotton blouse. The cream-colored shirt complemented her tanned skin and made her green eyes stand out sharply. She surveyed herself in the mirror, decided it would have to do, and caught a cab to Canela. Anya arrived at the restaurant promptly at 7. Apparently, she'd chosen well, as she drew more than a few glances, threading her way through the restaurant behind the maitre d'. Connolly was already at the table, waiting. He stood when he saw her approaching, and moved to hold her chair for her.
Thank you.
She sat and took the menu from the waiter.
What's good here?
Honestly, everything. The fish is flown in from the Mediterranean daily, and the beef is grass-fed from Australia.
They exchanged small talk while waiting for dinner, and then mostly ate in silence. The food was superb, everything Anya had expected it to be, and she was able to put the day's events behind her and enjoy the evening. While they were waiting for dessert, Connolly opened an attaché case at his feet, brought out an iPad, and turned it on. Without any explanation, he placed the iPad on the table in front of her. On the screen was the image of an ancient metal scroll, similar to the ones she'd been looking at that afternoon at the Shrine of the Book. In fact, she thought at first she was looking at the copper scroll again, except that the copper scroll had been cut into fragments to open it. This one was intact. The writing, however, appeared to also be the same Hebrew lettering.
Is it copper?
Bronze, actually. Though a tin alloy rather than an arsenic base.
Anya picked up the iPad and brought it closer, trying to make out the Hebrew characters. She recognized a few, but unfortunately, ancient Hebrew was not one of her fortes.
Swipe the screen to the left to see an English translation.
The translated document was laid out as the scroll had been, with two columns stretching down either side of the page, each with 32 separate stanzas. That similarity to the copper scroll didn't escape her.
Is it real?
As far as I can tell. I've had a variety of tests done on it, and my people are confident it isn't a hoax. Whether the information on it is correct or not, well, that's another issue.
That's the only issue, actually.
Ah, so you recognize it, do you?
I know what I think it is, at least. Whether you and I consider it to be the same thing remains to be seen.
Are you always this careful with what you say?
Of course. Aren't you?
Touché, Ms. Creed. Touché. I'm also a man who believes in getting to the point. The scroll, which I'm calling the Bronze Scroll, for obvious reasons, was discovered during an excavation in Masada in 2001. It was immediately placed in a private collection and remained there until I acquired that collection last month as partial payment on a business debt. I'm convinced that the Bronze Scroll is the mate to the Copper Scroll at the Shrine. Either one alone is useless, but together, they should lead us right to the ancient Jewish temple's hidden caches.
Us?
Yes, us. I would like to hire you to run the expedition for me. As I'm sure you've noticed, money is not an issue. You'll have the very best of whatever you need to get the job done.
Why not just do it yourself?
Me? What the hell do I know about running an expedition? I'll be along for the ride, but you'll be in charge of the details. There is, however, one caveat.
Which is?
Everything has to be ready to go within 72 hours. The permits I have in place with the Israeli government will expire in 3 days. If that happens, I will be forced to wait until next year before launching the expedition. Too much can happen. Knowledge of the scroll could leak to the wrong parties, another explorer might stumble upon one of the caches, hell, the Arabs and the Israelis might go to war. Those are risks I'm not willing to take. But if the effort is underway, the permit's extension clause is activated and I can stay in the field with the team an extra 90 days. 72 hours, not a moment longer. Can you do it?
You've got yourself an expedition leader.
Organizing an expedition, regardless of the size, was never easy. Putting one together at the last minute was most likely next to impossible. Anya knew this, and yet she was determined to meet the deadline because doing so meant she'd be able to get to work solving the mystery of the bronze and copper scrolls that much faster. Never mind the little issue of losing her spot on the expedition if they had to wait another season to get the permits reissued. Before the end of their meal the previous night, Connolly had told her she was free to use office space at the local branch of Excelsior Mining and Gas, and she showed up outside their front door shortly after 9 in the morning, ready to get to work. The secretary had been apprised of her arrival, and Anya was quickly shown to a large corner office that looked out onto the street behind the building. Anticipating that she would need some help, Connolly had also arranged for one of his senior VPs, Martin Grimes, to assist in whatever way she thought necessary. Grimes was in his mid-30s, a hard-looking, no-nonsense individual who was intimately familiar with the breadth and scope of Connolly's vast empire, and who apparently didn't know how to take no for an answer. He was there waiting for her when she arrived, and didn't waste any time rolling up his sleeves and diving into the task before them. Anya compiled a list of all the gear they would need to support the team in the field and to properly excavate each site. Since Grimes had direct access to the expense account Connolly had set up for the expedition, she handed the list over to him and left it in his hands to secure the items. That left her free to deal with personnel and logistics. A fair amount of the work on the latter had already been done, she quickly discovered. The permits were quite extensive, and upon seeing them, she instantly understood why Connolly didn't want them to go to waste. The Israeli government had hired Connolly's mining company to survey the Negev Desert for mineral and natural gas deposits. The agreement basically gave them carte blanche to go where they wanted outside the settled regions to drill for samples. The language was written rather loosely, no doubt something Connolly had pushed for, knowing what he intended to do with the permits, and would easily cover any excavation work. Anything found under the auspices of the permit had to be reported to the government, which helped the slight concern she still had that Connolly might abscond with the treasure. Satisfied that the expedition would be operating within the bounds of the law, Anya turned her attention to rounding up some experienced hands. Connolly might see this as a hunt for buried treasure, but Anya certainly didn't. If they actually found what they were looking for, it would have considerable import as an archaeological find, and she needed to make sure they properly documented and handled their finds. There were plenty of senior archaeologists she would love to have as part of the expedition, but it was unrealistic to expect them to drop whatever they were doing to join her dig on a day's notice, which meant she was going to have to go to an entirely different well. Anya picked up the phone and dialed a number from memory.
Good morning, Hebrew University of Jerusalem's Institute of Archaeology. Whom may I connect you with?
Could I please speak to Professor Ephraim Yellen?
Thank you, hold please.
Anya had met Ephraim at a symposium several years ago and had become fast friends, despite the fact that he was at least 30 years her senior. She'd been planning to stop in to see him later this week, until her dinner with Connolly the night before changed more than a few of her plans.
Hello?
Ephraim? It's Anya.
Anya! How good to hear from you. Has that TV program been keeping you busy?
Oh, more than I like to think about.
Well, then you need to get back in the field. Get your hands dirty. Archaeologists can't be away from the Earth too long, you know. Makes us cranky.
That's exactly why I'm calling, Ephraim. I need your help with something field-related.
Ask away, my dear girl.
I'm putting together a dig at the last minute. Just a small one, mind you, but I need extra hands to help with the field work.
Always in a hurry, aren't you, Anya? No matter. Tell me what you are after, and I'll see if I can help.
It's nothing, really. Just a client with a lead on the site of a possible first-century Roman encampment. I need 4, maybe 5 people on the ground with me to handle the client's request. Nothing fancy, basic experience will do.
First-century Roman, huh? A little outside your usual area, isn't it?
Aren't you the one who's always telling me that change is good for the soul, Ephraim? I needed to get my hands dirty and the opportunity fell into my lap. Do you think you can help me round up extra help?
If you don't mind graduate students, I can probably get you 6 or so. When do you need them?
Tomorrow morning?
A hurry is right. No matter. I'll have them by early tomorrow morning.
Thanks. I owe you one, Ephraim.
You owe me more than one, Anya. But don't worry, I'll just add it to your tab.
Knowing her need for warm bodies was taken care of, Anya turned her attention to scaring up the rest of the equipment they would need. She had given Grimes a list of the common supplies necessary for camp life, from tents to the many gallons of water they were no doubt going to consume under the desert sun, leaving her to procure the more dig-specific gear herself. A few calls to some friends in the field gave her the numbers of half a dozen suppliers in Jerusalem, and the fact that money wasn't an issue allowed her to have the gear delivered right to Connolly's offices starting that very afternoon. What she couldn't find directly from the suppliers, she was able to beg from the antiquities departments of two of the local universities. Grimes came back sometime in the afternoon and dropped six sets of keys on the desk in front of her.
What are these for?
Take a look out the window and see.
Anya got up, walked over to the window he was indicating, and spread the slats of the blinds open with one hand. Parked outside in the lot behind the building were six Land Cruisers, outfitted for expedition work with off-road tires and roof racks brimming with equipment. Three of the six were equipped with front-mounted winches, and each of them had spare tanks of gasoline in racks mounted on the rear doors.
Wow! Terrific! But why six? We'll have less than two people per vehicle.
You're forgetting about Mr. Connolly's security team.
Security team? How can I forget about a security team I haven't heard anything about yet?
Sorry. Must have been an oversight. After the events at the museum the other day, I've advised Mr. Connolly not to go anywhere without a nine-man security detail. They will accompany him on the expedition, but won't interfere in any way unless something occurs to put him in danger. I've taken the liberty of expanding your supply list to accommodate the eight extras.
Eight? I thought you said the security detail had nine men in it.
I'm the ninth.
Anya arrived outside the building that housed Ephraim's office the next morning, behind the wheel of one of their new expedition vehicles, and found six people and a pile of gear waiting for her. She parked, got out of the truck, and approached the closest, a stocky, gray-haired man of about 60.
Well, if it isn't the famous television star herself.
It's good to see you too, old friend.
Anya turned and surveyed the group. They were all in their early 20s, closer to Doug Morrell's age than her own. There were three men and two women waiting patiently behind Ephraim. Benjamin Nachiu was Israeli and doing PhD work on the Second Temple period of Jewish history. He'd worked with Ephraim on several of his expeditions and had the most field experience among the students. Mike Collins and Tony Green were big Midwestern boys from the University of Arkansas, where they were doing master's-level work on Paleolithic settlements and their impact on the rise of agriculture. They were currently in Jerusalem as part of an exchange program and had jumped at the chance to get out of the classroom and participate in an actual dig.
Well, you look as good in person as you do on television.
Tony immediately flushed bright red, which made Anya like him all the more.
Believe it or not, that's one of his better pickup lines.
Mike slapped Tony on the back. Tony flushed even brighter, if that was at all possible, and shot the tall blonde the finger, smiling all the while.
I might just like this little group.
The woman who'd spoken turned out to be Susan Hollister, a lithe blonde with pale blue eyes and an athlete's physique. She hailed from London and had come to Jerusalem specifically to study with Professor Yellen. Her friend, Rachel Golan, was a good 4 inches shorter, with a figure that could best be called plump and long dark hair the color of mud. Like Benjamin, she was a native Israeli and wasn't yet sure if she intended to dedicate her life to archaeology. When Hollister announced she was volunteering to join the group, Golan had quickly followed suit.
All right, children, settle down. Let's get the gear packed up and be on our way.
Our way?
Ephraim took Anya by the arm, and together they walked away until they were out of earshot from the students.
Yes, our way. You're up to something, I know it, and it's not just some first-century Roman household you're investigating now, is it?
Would I keep you in the dark like that, Ephraim?
Yes, you would. You can't fool my nose for intrigue, Anya Creed. When was the last time you worked an expedition, or did anything for that matter, without extensive planning? You're up to something. And when you're up to something, that usually means the rest of us are going to miss out on an amazing find. Not this time, I tell you. Not this time. I'm going with you.
All right, you win. Welcome aboard.
Grinning like the Cheshire Cat, Ephraim moved to help the others load the rest of the gear into the back of the truck. Anya couldn't fault him for his reasoning, which was, after all, correct. It would be a huge advantage to have him along. His knowledge of early Jewish history was practically encyclopedic. After arriving back at the EMG office Anya had been using as base camp, she put the graduate students to work organizing, packing, and then reloading the gear. While they were doing that, Anya took Ephraim into her office to bring him up to speed. She explained how the expedition was being sponsored by Mitchell Connolly, which Ephraim had already guessed, given they were currently sitting in the man's offices. She went on to tell him about the way Connolly had come into possession of the Bronze Scroll and what they hoped to do with it. Not surprisingly, Ephraim was intrigued. The Temple Mount had always been the center of Jewish faith. When the Romans had destroyed it for the second time at the end of the Second Jewish Revolt in 70 CE, they had done everything they could to wipe all trace of it off the face of the planet. Only the lower edges of the western wall of the temple complex still remained today, known the world over as the Wailing Wall. It had been the site of Jewish pilgrimages for centuries. Should the paired scrolls, bronze and copper, lead them to the temple's storied riches the way they expected them to? And should those riches be confirmed as having come from the temple complex in the months just before its destruction, they would have an immeasurable impact on Israel, not to mention the Jewish faith across the world. It was a daunting prospect. When she was finished, she rejoined Professor Yellen.
Anya, you realize what this could mean for the Jewish people, don't you?
Yes, I do.
You are aware of the legend of the guardians, yes?
No, I'm not. What guardians?
Legends say that the high priests in the temple knew Titus was going to order its destruction. Some say the message came from spies within the Roman legions. Others that it was a direct warning from God. In either case, the high priests acted on that warning, removing the treasure from the inner sanctum and arranging to have it split up and hidden in the countryside to keep it out of Roman hands. A group of warriors, known as the Giborim, or the Mightiest, were ordered to keep the treasure safe until it could be restored to its rightful place. Legend has it that the Giborim were directly descended from the mighty men of King David's reign.
But they wouldn't have been able to carry out their orders since the Romans destroyed the temple to put an end to the revolt.
Correct. Which is why there are those who say that the Giborim are still out there, guarding the treasure, passing down their responsibility through the generations until the temple is restored and the Jewish riches can be returned to the holiest of holies.
We'll worry about the Giborim if and when we find the treasure. In order to do that, we have to pick a place to start looking.
That was actually the most critical and most difficult task facing them. Late the night before, Anya had paired the verses from the Bronze Scroll with those from the Copper Scroll. She had assumed a direct one-to-one ratio. The first verse from the Bronze Scroll was paired with the first verse from the Copper Scroll. The stanzas seemed to fit together that way, or at least there weren't any obvious inconsistencies. For all she knew, the writer had tried to conceal the connection between the two documents by pairing them in reverse order, or some other more obscure method. The recipients had no doubt known the correct process, but Anya had nothing more to go on than the syntax of the stanzas themselves. If the writer had been clever with the layout, they were going to have to find out in the field the hard way. Now that the pairings were done, it was up to Anya and Ephraim to look them over and choose the ones they thought had the best chance of success. Finding even one of the hidden caches would tell them that their methods were correct and would make it immeasurably easier to find the others. They settled in to examine the possibilities and quickly found that even with the help of the information from the Bronze Scroll, the directions to the alleged treasure sites from the Copper Scroll were difficult to decipher. They were filled with references to what the writer no doubt thought would be obvious landmarks. For the most part, those references had long since passed out of popular knowledge. The two of them pored over the paired stanzas, looking for one in which the references were recognizable to the old Jewish archaeologist. Thankfully, it didn't take long. Ephraim's eyes lit up when he spotted the seventh pairing.
Listen. From the synagogue of the city and the strongholds where David dwelt, travel one day's march to the home of the tax collector, in the great cistern of the courtyard of the peristyle, in a hollow in the floor covered with sediment, in front of the upper opening, 90 talents.
Anya knew the first sentence had come from the bronze scroll, which gave them their starting point. The David referenced in the verse had to be King David, one of the ancient rulers of Israel and a major figure in the Old Testament. She did not, however, have any idea what city the verse was referring to, nor where David's strongholds might be found. From the look on his face, however, Ephraim did.
It is a reference to the 23rd verse of the first book of Samuel. And David went up from hence and dwelt in the strongholds of Engedi.
And you know where and what this Engedi is?
Yes, Anya. Engedi is both the name of an oasis and the town that was built alongside it. It is about 50 kilometers south of Jerusalem, not far from the shores of the Dead Sea.
Was there a synagogue there?
Anya, do you really need to ask?
Stupid question.
The ruins of the city are open to the public, as is the synagogue itself. It has the most beautiful stone mosaic floor, something you will not want to miss, I assure you. We can use that as our starting point and travel north until we find the ruins of the tax collector's house, if ruins still exist.
Right, if. Still, I've found archaeological sites on a lot less.
The morning of the third day after the meeting in the restaurant, the last day of the 72-hour deadline, dawned bright and clear. The team rose early and was ready to go by the time Connolly and his security team showed up just before 9. Grimes introduced Anya to each of the men. Anya did her best to remember their names: Hamilton, Mendez, Chan, the guy with the scar on his chin, the one with the nose that was broken that hadn't healed properly, but eventually gave up. She'd learned the names along the way, and that was that. They were all cut from the same cloth, it seemed. Hard, rugged men between the ages of 20 and 30, most with former military experience. They were polite, but didn't say much, and Anya knew they would do their jobs, and that was all. She doubted very much she was going to be getting any of them to sling shovelfuls of dirt. Anya and Grimes put their heads together for a few minutes and got everyone assigned to the appropriate vehicles. Anya, Grimes, and Connolly would take the lead. Immediately behind, two trucks would carry three security team members and their gear. The fourth truck would be driven by Tony and carry Rachel and Ephraim. Susan, Mike, and Benjamin would be in the fifth vehicle, with the final two security team members bringing up the rear in the sixth and last. Their first destination was Tel Gorin, a low hill just north of the western shore of the Dead Sea and about 60 miles southwest of Jerusalem. This was the site of the original village known as Engedi, a small village destroyed by the Assyrians around 600 BCE. From there, they would move slightly northeast, up along a nearby ridgeline to where the Jewish village of the same name had thrived during the Roman occupation of Israel. Internet research Anya had done the night before told her that the place had been large, about 40 acres, and prosperous from the date and perfume trade. As Ephraim had explained, the remains of the synagogue mentioned in the scroll still stood today, and it was from that point that they would begin their search for the house of the tax collector. If they could find that, they should be able to find the 90 talents, or so she hoped. Neither Grimes nor Connolly appeared to be in the mood for conversation, so Anya kept to herself as they made the hour and a half drive south from Jerusalem. The countryside reminded her of the time she'd spent at a dig in Iraq. There was the same rugged landscape, the same drab coloration. Occasionally, they would pass an oasis, where the bright green of the vegetation would break up the monotony of the rest of the countryside. But it didn't last long. By mid-morning, they reached Tel Goren and made the short drive up the ridgeline to the site of the ruins of Engidai. Most of the structures were nothing more than knee-high stone walls after all this time, but even so, Anya and the others were able to see how the town had been laid out for maximum use of the space available. The synagogue was easy to find because it was the only building over which a permanent tent-like structure had been erected to protect it from the elements. They parked as close as they were able. Anya waved Ephraim over to where she stood with Grimes and Connolly.
All right, Anya. It's your show. What's next?
From the synagogue of the city in the stronghold where David dwelt, travel one day's march to the home of the tax collector.
One day's travel? What's that? 10, maybe 15 miles at best over rugged ground like this?
No. It says one day's march, which means it is actually a measurement equal to the distance that a Roman legion could march in a typical 5-hour period.
20 miles. A fully equipped Roman legionnaire was required to march 20 miles a day.
Right. The Romans were rather exact, too. So when they said 20 miles, they meant 20 miles. We should be able to measure that with the truck's odometer and be pretty damn close to accurate. If there's anything left to find, we should be right on top of it at that point.
But how do we know which direction? Roads lead in every direction from this place.
The door to the synagogue always points in the same direction. Back toward Jerusalem. Back toward the Holy of Holies. That place within the temple where the Spirit of the Lord dwelt. Since the scroll mentions the synagogue as the starting place, any Jewish citizen of the time period would have known to travel in the same direction the synagogue faces. In this case, north.
They climbed back into their vehicles and began the drive north. There were no roads leading in this direction, and so they were forced to drive slowly, taking care to maneuver around outcroppings of rock and ravines large enough to swallow the vehicle whole. Just about an hour after they'd started, Grimes nodded.
Coming up on 19 miles.
Okay, pull over.
They got out of the vehicle and waited for the others to join them.